It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll check out some Irish music made right here in the state.
First, the Netflix series Making a Murderer drew international attention to criminal justice here in Wisconsin and to the murder conviction of Stephen Avery.
Now, two of the defense attorneys in the case are starting a speaking tour around the country. Billed as a conversation on justice, Dean Strang and Jerry Buting hope to raise issues of wrongful conviction, doubts about forensic evidence, and other problems they see in the criminal justice system.
The tour kicks off this Friday in Milwaukee at 8 p.m. at the Riverside Theater, and we have a link to event information on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jerry Buting joins us now. He's a criminal defense lawyer based in Brookfield. He was featured in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. Jerry, welcome to the show.
You're welcome.
Well, with the Making a Murderer series, and not just that, a lot of talk about criminal justice reform, bipartisan efforts to do this. Do you think, as you start this tour, that we're in a teachable moment here when it comes to criminal justice?
I do. I really do. This is, for one thing, this is the first presidential election I can remember where the topic of criminal justice reform has come up a number of times in the debate. So I think it shows it's a that there's an interest nationwide in this. And certainly the response that we've received, both Dean and I, shows an awful lot of people are concerned about what's going on in their criminal justice system and really interested in seeing, you know, how we can change things.
Do you think in general, based on not just the Stephen Avery case, you've done many other cases over the last few decades, is the deck stacked against defendants in our criminal justice system?
Well, yes, it is, and unfortunately, it has been for a while. Everything from the very, very low pay that's given to attorneys who are appointed by the public defender's office. You know, it's $40 an hour. When I started in 1981 in Wisconsin, it was $35 an hour out of court and $45 an hour in court. So it's actually gone down in a sense in 35 years. We are now the lowest in the country on the hourly rate. So, you know, that's a problem. It's very difficult to get good defense attorneys to take a lot of these cases that are indigents. And then on top of that, there's this feeling, and I don't know whether it's from television and movies or maybe just the media in general, but this feeling that if somebody is charged, they're probably guilty. You know, you see the perp walk where that's staged by law enforcement, where they dress the guy up in orange or black and white stripes and shackles and make him look not only guilty but dangerous. And that's what gets repeated over and over and over in the news when there's when there are follow-up stories. So, you know, the loss of the presumption of innocence that was really designed and on which our system was founded really does stack the deck against most defendants.
You've also been very critical of forensic evidence and crime labs. Does the public have too much faith in forensic science? Maybe you mentioned TV based on what they've seen on CSI, shows like that.
Yes, I do. Now, the prosecutors are worried about the CSI effect as well because they think that people expect too much. But for many years, there's been a problem. In fact, there was a National Science Academy NSA report on forensics for forensic science probably 4 or 5 years ago, and not much has been done about it, but it was very critical of the majority of forensic so-called science fields because most of what they have offered as science has never been validated like science. And now we're finding, you know, for instance, many people were convicted, sometimes of murder, in the past based upon what's called hair comparison analysis, where you would take a hair found at the crime scene and compare it to a reference sample hair from the suspect, put them under a double microscope, look at them, and then an opinion would be given, yeah, this is consistent with or this is similar to the crime scene hair. And we now know, in fact, the FBI has admitted that that's totally bogus science. And we know because later some people who were claimed to have matched hair samples microscopically later were exonerated by DNA for the very same offense. So that's one example. There's other tool mark evidence where police officers or crime lab people will come in and claim that a bullet came from one particular gun or rifle and no other gun in the world. And that's just preposterous. Many years ago, when guns were hand-forged and there would be sort of really unique striations and marks on the inside of the barrels of those guns, and that would sometimes, those marks would sometimes be left on a bullet that's fired for the gun, and you could then say, hey, it came from this gun and no other. But guns are mass-produced now. They come off the line, thousands at a time, and they're all the same. And so that kind of science is heavily challenged, as is arson experts. So the list goes on and on.
Talking to attorney Jerry Buting, he and his colleague Dean Strang are kicking off a tour, a multi-city tour, talking about the criminal justice system. They're both featured in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. In the response, Jerry, to Making a Murderer, a lot of people really obviously followed this very closely. Looking online, you see a lot of people going through evidence themselves, signing petitions, conspiracy theories. I've seen aliens come up a couple times. Do you worry that people are focused so much on this case and maybe not enough on the wider issues that you're hoping this raises?
Well, I'm not worried about it. I know there are some maybe who spend perhaps too much time focusing on all the specific evidence that came out in this case. But I think along with it, they are recognizing, and one reason they are so interested in doing all this is they're recognizing that, the justice system in this case left an awful lot of questions. The trial left, I thought, an abundance of reasonable doubt, as the documentary shows. And so people are curious about that. And one of the things that we were not allowed to do in the Avery case was point to the jury specific evidence of other suspects. We were not able to present any evidence that pointed to other suspects. And I knew that in a case like this, people were going to be very curious, well, if Stephen Avery didn't do it, then who did? And so that's why there's a lot of speculation on Reddit and other online social media about who could have killed Teresa Halbach, and that's where some of the various theories come up. And unfortunately, because of an overly strict evidentiary rule, the judge prevented us from presenting evidence that may have cleared up some of those questions.
What kind of reforms would make you feel more confident in future cases that all points were being considered, all necessary evidence was being presented?
Well, we'll start with the last one. One of the reforms, the rule of law that barred us from pointing out other suspects and presenting evidence that would show other suspects maybe have committed this offense is simply an evidentiary rule. It could be modified by legislation, and that has to be done. People need to. It's just too strict the way it's been interpreted in other cases. Probably the biggest one, though, the one that I get the most comments on, are the parts of the documentary where that look at the interrogation of juvenile 16-year-old Brendan Dassey, and people are shocked and amazed that, you mean to tell me that the police can come and take a child out of class and bring him down to the principal's office and then arrest him and interrogate him, and the parent never has to be even called? And the answer is yes, and it happens in Wisconsin probably every day or close to it. I'm amazed the number of people that come in, parents that come to me and say, I can't believe they never called me, and they call you later. And to subject a 16-year-old or any juvenile to an interrogation by trained police officers without a parent or better than that, a lawyer present, is really unfair. It's, with the kinds of psychological techniques that they can get kids to fall for, and they overcome their will, and they end up making statements that aren't true just because they're trying to get out of difficult situations. So that can and should be changed. And there are, in fact, bills pending in several states' legislatures to bar that practice. And I think we should do that in Wisconsin as well.
Do you worry that we might tip the bar too far and make it too hard for prosecutors to successfully prosecute the actual criminals in cases?
No, I don't, because if the case is strong enough, then they ought to be able to prove it without coercing an interrogation from somebody. You know, if the case against Brendan Dassey was so strong, then throw his statement out and prove it. Now, in that case, they won't be able to prove it because there was no other evidence against Brendan Dassey other than that coerced confession, false confession. And so in those kinds of cases, it will protect the innocent and point them in the direction of somebody else. Where does the evidence point to? Who else would be a suspect? That's what they should focus on. They have all kinds of DNA tests now that are making it easier for them to prove their case. They don't need and shouldn't be able to use coerced confessions, uncounseled from juveniles.
We'll leave it there for now. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Jerry Buting, criminal defense lawyer based in Brookfield. He was featured in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. He and Dean Strang start their Conversation About Justice tour this Friday at 8 in Milwaukee's Riverside Theater. We've got event info linked to the Central Time Facebook page. But we tend to associate Germans with Milwaukee. The Irish were the city's first major immigrant group. Historian John Goethe describes the Celtic imprint on Milwaukee.
On St. Patrick's Day, the saying goes, we're all Irish. That's an exaggeration, of course, but parts of Milwaukee are awash in green beer and shamrocks every March 17th. Although the event is a thoroughly modern excuse to party, St. Paddy's Day also celebrates the city's first major immigrant group. Milwaukee's Celtic pioneers arrived in the mid-1830s, one step ahead of the Germans. Beset by famine and bullied by their English overlords, more immigrants left the old sod every year. By 1848, the Irish made up 15% of Milwaukee's population, which proved to be their historic high point. The vast majority settled in the Third Ward on the edge of downtown, where they promptly formed the city's first ghetto. Now a bustling capital of chic, the ward was anything but fashionable in the mid-1800s. It was a filled-in swamp commonly known as the Bloody Third, a reputation earned with fisticuffs. The Irish enclave had the city's largest collection of saloons, and whiskey-fueled altercations were common. When the police tallied their arrests for 1859, Irish scofflaws made up 38% of the total, more than five times their share of the population. In 1857, the Milwaukee Sentinel praised a local Irishman but damned his neighborhood. O'Byrne stands out as a good, peaceable, and upright man and citizen. If all in the Third Ward were like him, the police might be safely disbanded today. Despite their rough start, the Irish made the most of their opportunities. Decade by decade, they moved up and out, generally to the west. For many, the first stop was Torrey Hill, a neighborhood now buried beneath the Marquette University campus. Their next step west was Merrill Park, a settlement of Irish railroad workers on the north rim of the Menominee Valley. There they founded St. Rose Church, a congregation whose membership roster read like the Dublin phone book. Generations later, Merrill Park is still the neighborhood of sainted memory for hundreds of Irish Milwaukeeans. Politics became an almost stereotypical path to higher ground. Fluent in English, famously fond of discourse, and apt to form vote-rich clusters in large cities, the Irish had a major impact on American politics, and Milwaukee was no exception. In 1844, Irishman Thomas Gilbert was elected village president. Following cityhood 2 years later, there was a procession of Irish mayors. Among them, a Dublin-born lawyer with the unlikely name of Hans Crocker, and most famous of all, Daniel Webster Hone. Hone was a socialist who led Milwaukee from 1916 to 1940 and made it one of the best-governed big cities in America. The tradition continues today under another Irishman, Tom Barrett. In truth, Germans had a greater impact, but the Irish imprint on Milwaukee is indelible in politics, in cultural life, and certainly in celebrations. Since its debut in 1981, Irish Fest has grown to become the city's largest ethnic festival, drawing well over 100,000 revelers each year to the largest celebration of Irish music, culture, and cuisine on the planet. So whatever your background, raise a glass of Guinness to the Irish this St. Patrick's Day. Arriving with nothing but hope, they have scaled the heights and added a welcome touch of green to this wintry northern city.
John Goethe is an award-winning Milwaukee historian. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
And we'll keep the Irish music going now as we ramp up to St. Patrick's Day later this week. We're joined by WPR's music librarian, Sheila Shigley. She's here to share some of her favorite Irish music from groups here in Wisconsin. Sheila, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, folks. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's Irish music is a pretty broad descriptor. That's a lot of music over a long time period. What are some of the key features, the instruments that are most common to the music we'll hear?
You know, it's kind of a walk through time. I mean, nowadays, if somebody shows up to an Irish music session with a saxophone, I mean, it's happened, you know, people will say, well, that's really not
Irish. So I'd be welcome there.
You'd be welcome there. But, you know, 1,000 years ago, if somebody showed up to a session with a fiddle, they'd say, that's not proper. You know, so through time, you think of the quintessential Irish instruments as being the harp, the fiddle, and to some extent the Irish drum, which is sort of ubiquitous now.
And are there different genres that we should be aware of as we're listening?
There are. There's anything from the oldest of the old, which is often thought of as being solo performances of like solo fiddle piece or a solo harp, solo voice. And then over time, people started playing in groups, maybe starting around the 40s. And then now people add electric guitars and it just goes off the rails in a very beautiful way.
Let's hear some music. Let's start off a little more traditional with Turner Collins. So what are we hearing there from Turner Collins, Sheila?
We are hearing a very, very old Gaelic piece, probably composed sometime in the 1500s, possibly earlier, called Bright Quiet Ailey. And harpists were employed, musicians back then, they would be employed by rich people especially to compose tunes about their loved ones or about the lord of the estate or to commemorate some event. And this is about a young lady who was very much appreciated by the community and everyone wanted to marry her, basically. So this tune has stuck around quite a while. And Turner there is playing a Celtic harp, which is a little different from the harps that we see in the symphony and so forth.
And another aspect of all this, pretty popular right now around St. Patrick's Day, is the idea of the Irish pub band, and you brought some along for that. What is Irish pub music like?
Well, Irish pub music can be anything from what we call green beer music, which is just sort of rough and tumble, hard to distinguish from country music sometimes, to actual old rebel songs, or even instrumentals that is played to like keep people's spirits up. So I think we're going to hear an instrumental possibly here coming up.
Okay. You've got a dance song. Who is this?
This is the Wisconsin group, the Curragh.
There's that Irish drum you mentioned, and I never know how to pronounce Boron.
It is pronounced Boron or Balron. It's spelled B-O-D-H-R-A-N, and it used to be something that you would winnow grain with. And then at some point they found out that it makes a great thumping noise, and it's actually throughout all the Celtic lands, but we think of it as being Irish these days.
And you've got another one from the Curragh, and I don't know if I should try to pronounce this, but I'm going to, Jaco Hazeldine.
Jaco Hazeldine. It's a well-loved ballad. So usually what happens these days in pubs is you'll have a lot of instrumentals going, and then people will quiet down and listen to a great old ballad, and here's one of those.
Tell us about that one.
So that's Josh Perkins, Wisconsin bass musician, singing a very well loved ballad called Jock O'Hazeldine, and this told the story of Jock O'Hazeldine and his rampages through the world. And so, even in a big noisy pub these days, you can usually get the whole the whole place to kind of quiet down if they can tell that there's a singer trying to get the notes
heard,
out.
Yeah.
Special moment always in an Irish session.
You know whereof you speak, right?
Sometimes they don't quiet down always, but often they will, and it's a lovely, lovely moment.
Let's check out one more Mizirk. Am I saying this right? A more modern take on Irish music?
This is Mizirk. Brett Lipschitz and Randy Gosa and Asher Gray. I hope they'll forgive me. I'm using them as the Irish music running off the rails example. But no, they have this fusion of jazz and rock. This is not quite out there, but you'll get a taste.
Sheila, as we wrap up here, what are you going to be doing for St. Paddy's Day? You're a musician, a singer, all of this. What's your dance card look like?
Well, today I played for the Redruth Senior Center St. Patrick's Day Luncheon, and I just love the Americanness of that. And they always have us every year, and it's so much fun. And then we're going to be playing around town all through from dusk till dawn on March 17th, and I think we have a few spillover gigs after that. So
nice. You'll be busy, and you'll be very sleepy come next week.
I'll probably sleep for about a week and then wake up in time for Milwaukee Irish Fest.
Well, Sheila, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sheila Shigley, music librarian at WPR, and occasional voice of Simply Folk, sharing some Irish music made in Wisconsin.
Coming up, California could soon raise the legal minimum smoking age to 21. We'll talk about whether or not these laws are effective and whether that change would be right for Wisconsin. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. California lawmakers approved a bill last week that would raise the minimum age for buying cigarettes or vaping products from 18 to 21.
If it's approved by the governor there, it would make California one of the first states to pass a law raising the minimum smoking age. It would make it the most populous state to have such a measure on the books.
But are laws like this one effective? Do these laws deter young people from picking up smoking, and could it set a precedent for the rest of the country?
We'll hear from a Wisconsin-based news editor who's calling for a similar law to be passed here, and we'll take your calls in a little bit later in the show.
But now joining us to talk about that law is Patrick Remington. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So from that public health perspective, what is your take on the news that California is looking likely to pursue this measure, raising the smoking age to 21?
Well, the first question is, will it be effective? Will fewer people take up smoking? And the research is pretty clear on that if you ban smoking, make it illegal to possess cigarettes or sell cigarettes to those 18 to 20 years of age, that fewer people will buy them and fewer people will smoke. So that's pretty clear. I don't think that's debated. The obvious debate is whether people over the age of 18 or 18 and older should be can't make that decision themselves and should have a law prohibiting them from smoking. And I think that's where the controversy is.
Right. And how do you start unpacking that last question?
Well, there are two sides to that question. One is a broader responsibility in society to reduce the amazing burden from cigarette smoking. Although many of your listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio have either quit themselves or aren't exposed to cigarette smoke every day, we still in Wisconsin have 1 million people who smoke regularly. It's the leading preventable cause of death in the U.S. and in Wisconsin. Probably 7,000 or 8,000 people die in our state each year from cigarette smoking. From that perspective, not doing something like this could be viewed as a sort of public health malpractice. But the flip side of it is we often recognize 18 as at the age in which people can become adults, they can serve in the military, they can basically go out on their own, and yet this law would tell them that they don't have the judgment yet to know whether they should take up cigarette smoking. They have to wait until they're 21 to do so. Parallel, really, to many drinking laws.
As far as that military argument, it sounds as though California Democrats did write in if you were serving in the military, you could then buy cigarettes. So it's not without some controversy in California. Now, California follows Hawaii on this. Does that mean we could be looking at a precedent here, a domino effect?
Well, again, I think it's a balance of the needs for public health improvement. There's quite an active coalition in Wisconsin with the American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Lung Association, and many organizations that fight every day to prevent people from starting to smoke and to help smokers quit. So I think there is a movement to do more than is currently being done. It wasn't that long ago when we were debating whether it's reasonable to prohibit people from smoking in bars or restaurants. And that was quite a divisive issue between the restaurant industry, the Tavern League, and health advocates. And now, a decade later, the sky hasn't fallen in. People continue to go out and dine and drink in bars, and yet their health is protected. So it could be the same outcome with this issue, that if the age at which people can buy cigarettes legally becomes 21, eventually that will become the norm and people will get used to it.
Short of going as far as making the age 21, as California looks poised to do, are there other efforts and initiatives that Wisconsin could pick up on, or has Wisconsin done most of what you think is the most effective?
Well, there are clearly many efforts that have been underway. But one of the most important ones was prohibiting smoking indoors where people work or dine. And that is a significant change to protect non-smokers. But the efforts need to really now redirect towards helping smokers either quit smoking or, more importantly, helping young kids to keep from smoking. And raising the legal purchase age or enforcing current restrictions on sales to minors, those are some activities that are effective, and certainly we can do more. Obviously, if we could remove smoking in many movies and on television where it's viewed as normative, that's a huge influence for young people who watch movies and television and think they only see the positives, the glamour of cigarette smoking, and they're never shown the adverse health effects. So clearly we need to not just think about restricting access through raising the minimum age, but to have a comprehensive program.
We're talking with public health expert Patrick Remington from UW-Madison, talking about a law that is set to pass in California that would raise the legal age to buy cigarettes to 21. And again, Patrick, it's not without some controversy, including the tobacco industry. But is there any evidence suggesting that laws like this are not effective?
Well, again, they're not effective for everyone. Most smokers begin smoking before the age of 18, and we have a law in this state which bans people under the age of 18 from purchasing or possessing cigarettes. So clearly the laws aren't perfectly effective, but evidence shows that if you restrict access by making it illegal to purchase by 21 until you're 21, that it will have an impact and it will contribute to all the other things that we're doing. It is of interest, I think, that when you survey older smokers and ask them their opinion about this law, a majority of smokers are in favor of it because they realize that their decision to smoke cigarettes wasn't really made understanding the potential for nicotine addiction to later in life keep them from quitting. 90% of smokers would like to quit if they could, but nicotine is an incredibly addictive drug. And so they look back and say it would have been helpful if it might have been helpful for them if there had been a law keeping them from buying cigarettes.
I imagine a lot of people are exposed to the normalization of cigarette smoking at home. Is there anything there that's effective in helping children reduce that kind of exposure?
Well, physicians play an important role in this, in that oftentimes kids are seen in a pediatrician's office where they have asthma or allergies or ear infections. And physicians ask the parent. They often know just because the smell of cigarettes on the child's clothing. But that's advice that can be given to parents to say that if you can't quit, at least don't smoke in your own home so that you're exposing your child to the health risks of smoking. Obviously, the teenage years are a time when kids go on their own and they make their own decisions. And I think a role of society is to try and provide conditions so that people can make the right choice. And if cigarettes are low cost and widely accessible, we know more kids will start to smoke than if they're higher cost through excise taxes or if purchasing or possessing them is illegal.
And this law in California, it also addresses vaping, which has been spiking in popularity, especially among younger people. What do we know about the possible dangers of vaping?
Well, we don't know enough. Vaping is a way to get nicotine, but without all of the harmful chemicals in cigarettes. So on the one hand, advocates of vaping talk about it as a safer alternative, that perhaps people can get their nicotine but not become a cigarette smoker. The argument against it is we just don't know what the life course is for somebody who begins vaping as a teenager, but then maybe in 5, 10, or 15 years they will become a cigarette smoker. There's evidence in Europe through another substance called snus that these alternative nicotine delivery systems might reduce the rate of cigarette smoking, but it's certainly too early to tell. So I think the evidence is take precaution. And until we know for sure, treat vaping just as we would cigarettes.
We're talking with Patrick Remington right now. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about a new law in California that will raise the minimum age for buying cigarettes from 18 to 21.
We'll be joined in just a moment by a state journalist who's calling for Wisconsin to pick up a similar measure that would raise that minimum age for cigarette sales. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin pass a similar law, raise the minimum age for purchasing tobacco products from 18 to 21? Again, the number is 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about a bill that passed the California legislature that would raise the minimum age a person could buy cigarettes from 18 to 21, and we'll hear the case for doing that here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin raise the smoking age in effect from 18 to 21? Let us know what you think, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Patrick Remington stays with us now. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're also joined now by Rob Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He wrote an opinion piece for the Wausau Daily Herald calling for Wisconsin to follow in California's footsteps and raise the minimum age to purchase cigarettes to 21. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks.
So why did you decide to write this article about backing California's decision to maybe raise the limit to 21?
So this seems like an interesting idea to me. Wisconsin is not typically a sort of an innovator on public health policy for all kinds of reasons. But this is a policy that so Hawaii picked it up and California picked it up. And what I think is probably more likely in Wisconsin than that we would immediately move towards a statewide ban is that individual municipalities could adopt this policy. So Madison could do it, or Wausau could do it, or wherever. And that in itself, though it certainly wouldn't have the same effect as having it be statewide, it would be interesting to see if that had an effect in these individual cities. So this could be a policy, if it catches on, that moves in sort of a similar fashion as the workplace smoking ban did.
If we were looking at the statewide age shift to 21 in Wisconsin, you have to look at California, pretty culturally different than Wisconsin, than the Midwest. Do you see Wisconsin voters being on board with something like this?
Nope, I don't. But guess what? I'm not running for anything. I just get to write what I think. It seems like it would be a hard sell, and certainly it is. It goes against a lot of people's sense of when you're 18, you're an adult, and you should be able to do adult things, and that's fine. That's true. But with cigarettes specifically, we do a lot of things to distort that market already. We tax them at increasingly steep rates. We regulate all kinds of things about cigarette sales, and this, to me, my argument as a commentator, as an observer, is that it's not so different in kind to raise the age at which you can buy it, and to do the many things that we already do as a matter of policy to try to discourage people from smoking. And we do it because it's really bad for you to smoke. It's like has like a lot of bad effects. It's something that we should want to discourage.
And we're going to take our first caller now. Tracy is with us, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should Wisconsin, maybe at the level of a city, municipality, doing this, changing the legal age to buy cigarettes from 18 to 21 years old? That's what California is doing. And Tracy from Green Bay, you're up. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. While I think that legislation such as this has its heart in the right place, I think that if we look at alcohol use in Wisconsin, when it used to be 18 years old to drink and then 19 and then 21 because we had the federal government telling us that we wouldn't receive funding for road reconstruction and things like that. So Wisconsin finally succumbed. And arguably, I wouldn't say that any child, much less 18, 19, or 20-year-old, drinks less than they would if they could. So I'm just not sure that changing the smoking age or the ability to have tobacco in your possession is really going to change anything. They'll just do what kids have done with alcohol, get it from an older sibling or an older friend, or get a fake ID of some sort. So I think that. Again, the heart of the issue, I think it's all there. I'm just not sure that this is going to really help anything.
Tracy, appreciate that call. And I want to get Patrick Remington back in on this conversation. Now, the Los Angeles Times ran a dissenting piece and up to this change in law that is looking likely to happen, saying that actually it doesn't always work raising the legal age to buy cigarettes. In fact, that this person is saying that the data just isn't there. So is there some controversy about whether this could be effective? Will older people just buy it for younger kids and it will be kind of a wash?
Well, certainly it doesn't always work. That's that's well known. But the big thing with access to cigarettes is that kids in high school, half of kids in high school turn 18. And it turns out that there's a lot of cigarette smoking that begins when kids are seniors because half the class can legally purchase the cigarettes. So one of the benefits of raising the age to 21 is that you remove cigarettes from high schools, from high school kids that would be legally purchased. The second issue has to do with enforcement of sales. Yes, you could always get a 25-year-old brother to buy your cigarettes. But if the law were to be enforced, then it does reduce sales. And there's evidence that there's a slight reduction in cigarette smoking uptake. Again, it's not the silver bullet to solve the smoking epidemic, but it will be one piece of the puzzle to try and reduce the burden. Cigarettes are really the only product that I can think of that, when used as intended, kills about a third to a half of its users. So that as the caller said, I think not only is it a good idea, I think we have to put it together with many other things to prevent kids from starting to smoke and to help adults quit.
And Rob, I want to ask you to another of Tracy's points. Is this something that seems a little bit to have too much oversight from the government? Lots of things are bad for you, and then the government, we can't make laws about all of them. Is raising this legal by age of 21, is it going too far?
Sure. Well, lots of things are bad for you, and the government can't be involved in all of them and shouldn't be. That's true. I do think smoking is a different case. Cigarettes are almost only bad. Patrick Remington quoted the statistic, 80 to 90% of smokers want to quit. And the death rates are really high. That's for, alcohol, which is regulated to only be purchased after 21, is actually healthy and fine. It's sort of used in moderation. That's not true of cigarettes. Cigarettes, it seems to me, have much less upside, if any, and a much stronger downside. It seems like the cost of regulating them is small.
And thanks a lot to Tracy for that call. We're going to go next to Rich, and Rich is joining us from Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, my comment is I work in the health field, and I work in Wisconsin, and most of the people do smoke. And it's really hard to not judge them, and I wish they didn't smoke, but it's not us to determine that. So for the government to overreach and keep bending the law, and trying to control it. When there is I've studied nicotine receptors in the body that have been there that only get stimulated through nicotine. So the craving is there, and it's always going to be there. And to change the law according to what you think you're doing is fruitless, and it's bending it when you shouldn't.
Rich, I want to ask you, what do you think about the smoking laws that Wisconsin currently has on the books?
I think it's all good, you know. I mean, deter people. People shouldn't smoke. I mean, but at the same time, I understand why they smoke. They smoke and it releases dopamine in the brain, and there are studies that show that there's less amount of dementia and Alzheimer's disease in people that do smoke. And the reason why is because it's a physically addictive drug that we have been taking into our body for centuries.
Rich, thanks a lot for your thoughts. And Patrick, let's start with you. What would you say to Rich's thoughts?
Well, I think he makes a good point in that many people do smoke, particularly if you work in the healthcare field, because you see them being treated for smoking-related diseases. Although there are some very unusual health benefits, such as perhaps a delay in dementia and maybe a reduction in some cancers, by far, cigarette smoking, the harms of cigarette smoking clearly outweigh the harms. I think this isn't a question of whether the government should tell people what to do. I think it's people deciding what should be done. And in California, the elected representatives who, you know, if they do the wrong thing, they're going to be out of office and this law could be overturned, or if the governor signs it, which I think he is likely to, he could be put out of office. So it's not really the government telling people what to do. It's a consensus based on evidence that smoking is harmful, and not just a little bit harmful, but amazingly harmful, that people on average lose about 7 years of life if they continue to smoke. The average smoker who dies from a smoking-related illness loses about 20 years of life. So that's a lot of burden. And again, most smokers would like to quit, and most smokers would be in favor of this law. So I think it's that perspective of looking back and saying, I wish I hadn't taken up this habit, because, as the caller said, nicotine is one of the most addictive substances we know of.
And, Rob, did you want to respond to our caller?
Yeah, I mean, I am against putting people in jail for being addicted to cigarettes. But, I mean, that's really not what we're talking about. We're talking about, writing people a ticket if they're 19 years old and trying to buy cigarettes or a 21-year-old buying for a 16-year-old. There's sort of reasonable limits, and people can quit smoking. They do quit smoking, and we should look at all kinds of a multi-pronged approach for helping them do so. And you know what? Raising the cigarette smoking age might be one part of that.
And Rob, you said earlier you didn't really think there was an appetite for this, certainly at the state level, but do you see possible cities, municipalities being interested in trying this at that level?
I have not heard a single one mention it. I think I'm the first. Maybe I will. Maybe we can start a movement here. But you know, it is the sort of thing that could imagine happening on the local level. So this is often the way it goes. There could be Ashland, Wisconsin could be especially interested in public health policy and get a few people in there on their side on the city council or who knows where. What would be interesting then is you see, does it have an effect? Does it do youth smoking rates go down there? And if so, then you have a strong argument. If it doesn't work, then you have to think about some other policies maybe.
And we leave it there. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
And Patrick, thanks to you too.
Thanks, Veronica.
We've been talking to public health researcher Patrick Remington from UW-Madison and Rob Menser from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. They joined us to talk about the idea of raising the smoking age to 21.